the Can Innovate podcast, where we highlight Canadian innovators who are changing the game. I'm Sapna Malhotra, your proud Canadian host. The Can Innovate podcast is about providing industry insights from Canadian innovators that are doing it. They are really crushing it out there in the industry. These innovators share insightful thought leadership, tips, tricks, vague tactics that we can all adopt. Plus, they even share their own entrepreneurial tales of successes and failures, and they really show us how what we can learn. So let's continue to innovate our own businesses, lives, and careers. And if you know of any Canadian innovators that should be featured, drop us a line. You know I love getting feedback and hearing from everyone. You can contact me via email, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and of course, hint, hint, even in a review. All right, let's get to this episode. We are honored today to have Alon Gobo, who is the co-founder and COO and CFO of FarmLead, an online grain marketplace where farmers and grain buyers can buy and sell any type of grain. Alon also has extensive project management and operation experience as a field engineer throughout Europe and Asia, and as a co-founder at AltaEros Energies, a telecom infrastructure startup based in Boston. He's also previously worked with McKinsey and Company in the agribusiness team. And of course, Alon, who is also raised on a farm in Eastern Ontario. Did I miss anything in that intro?
No, I think that's a great summary.
Excellent. So Alon, it makes sense. You grew up as a farmer and now you're producing a solution for farmers. So for our listeners out there, can you tell us exactly what FarmLead is and how it all came about?
Sure. So overall, you have to think of FarmLead as a business-to-business marketplace. Farms or farmers at the end of the day run a business, and that business is basically producing and selling, in this particular case, grains. And there's a bunch of other businesses that are buying that grain. They are either mills that will take wheat and turn it into a product that then goes off, flour basically, that goes off to bakeries or pasta producers. It can be things like food processors will take raw lentils or peas, clean them, bag them, and basically send them off to a grocery store. There are people raising cattle or chickens or pigs. There are people converting corn or wheat into ethanol, and there's a whole other gamut of products that are derived from grain. And both these businesses, the producers of those grain, the farmers, and the buyers or processors or intermediates, need to connect. Hence, FarmLead. So really what we are is we're an online marketplace where buyers and sellers can list what they're either looking to buy or sell, negotiate with each other, come to terms, and then manage these transactions. Now, why did we start this business? Pretty straightforward, where there's a bunch of different reasons, really. My business partner is from Western Canada. I myself, my family farms in Eastern Canada. And both our families were kind of coming up with facing the same challenge, except it was, you know, different sides of the same coin. Particularly in Canada, the dismantling of the wheat board, which happened in I think, 2011, 2012 era, kind of opened up a whole bunch of new marketing channels for grain producers. But it also meant it's a bit more complex, whereas in the past, you had to sell your grain or basically gave your grain to sell to one entity. Suddenly, you had to handle that selling entirely on your own, which means you have to handle contacting a variety of potential buyers. You have to understand what you're trying to sell. You have to negotiate the different terms that revolve around, obviously, price, but also the quantity, exactly when the grain is going to be picked up or delivered. Freight terms, is the buyer going to pick it up at your farm? Is the buyer expecting you to deliver the grain? And many other sort of subtleties that suddenly producers find themselves having to take care of. In my part of the world, you know, my family is at core a dairy producing operation, and we actually buy a fair amount of grains to feed our cattle, but we also, over the years, have started producing more grain as a bit of a side business to our dairy operation. It's complementary in a variety of different ways, but it also means that we suddenly have to market grain, and our easy way of doing so was to work with a local intermediate, an elevator, typically that provides services around storing the grain, drying it, and so forth, but also marketing it on our behalf. But frankly, we're also very interested in marketing the grain ourselves, but we didn't necessarily have the toolkit or the time to do that. If you're a dairy producer, you focus on your cows first, everything else is secondary. But as you're starting to produce 2, 3, 500, 1,000 tons of grain a year, you probably want to gain some efficiency by not paying someone to do that marketing for you. Hence, oh, if there was a tool that would help me connect with the potential buyers for the grain I'm trying to sell, Farmly makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, whether you're in Western Canada producing different types of wheat, lentils, pulses, flax, and other oil seeds, or if you're in Eastern Canada where you tend to focus more on corn, soybean, some wheat, perhaps some small cereals like oats or barley, you run up against the same situation, which is it's easy to call one or two potential buyers, but when you know that there's maybe 10 potential buyers out there, it gets pretty intense very quickly to stay up to date with all those opportunities, especially if you demultiply it by, well, if I'm producing 3 or 5 or 6 different types of crops, and for each of those crops, I'm making 3 to 5 sales throughout the calendar year, you quickly see how the numbers add up, and you're at any moment trying to find 20, 30 sale opportunities throughout the year, each of which can have 5 to 10 buyers associated with them. You need something to help you get that job done. And that's what the Farmly Marketplace effectively tries to do.
That's brilliant. You've really opened up the buyer and seller marketplace altogether. That's really changing this total industry. So is the markets that you're doing this around only based in Canada, or is there other geographies?
We effectively started in Western Canada, and then in the period of around 2015, we started extending into Eastern Canada and, you know, Eastern to relativize, we're speaking Ontario and a little bit of Quebec. Western Canada, really Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and a little bit of Eastern British Columbia. But then we actually went off and raised a Series A in March 2017, $6.5 million US. And with that money, we've effectively started expanding into the US. We actually have a headquarter office in Ottawa, but we also have an office in Chicago. And right now we're actively developing what we call the Northern Plains. So Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, and starting to also establish our presence in the Central Plains, largely at this point, Nebraska, Kansas area. Really, for us, when we go into a new market, like any marketplace, we need to build a base of both supply and demand. Basically, we need farmers and we need buyers active on the platform to turn it into an active marketplace. So we try to go area by area at a time as we're growing and expanding into new geographies.
Nice. So is there plans for global expansion?
Yeah. So we certainly see a need for this in other geographies. The key thing to note is we focus on domestic grain markets. So we don't organize the export of, say, 20,000 ton boats from Canada or the US to China or to Europe. But what we do is we help the companies that are doing these exports. They're known as the ABCDs of the world. And then there's other permutation, but ADM, Louis Dreyfus, Cargill, and Bunge. They need to do what's called originate grain so they can fill their boats or fill their processing facilities. It's that origination process where we help them. We help them identify where there's grain available in a particular geography and basically negotiate and secure that grain. That problem of, on a domestic market, identifying who are the buyers and sellers, whatever permutation they may be at any given moment, exists in many markets. We see it in Latin America. We see it in parts of Europe, specifically or more strongly in Eastern Europe and Black Sea areas. We see it in South Africa and surrounding countries. We see it in Australia. So there's clearly opportunity to expand what we do. And it is, you know, on our radar to look at international markets. you know, it's something that we're certainly keeping a radar and looking at different ways and talking to potential people that we could work with in order to accomplish that. But at least in, you know, the sort of medium term, we're also very focused on establishing a strong presence in the North American market. You know, there's a significant amount of grain, 700 million tons that moves around in North America alone every year. And we're just starting to scratch the surface of where we can help connect the buyers and sellers in those different markets.
Excellent. So eventually there'll be some world global domination. So how did you get this idea off the ground?
Like any opportunity, you need to start with the customer. And so, you know, first step was really to, and this was particularly my business partner in the early days in Western Canada, really sit down with producers, you know, farmers, and explain the concept and try to understand effectively how do you market your grain today? And that was kind of the first way of understanding what the product should look like, realizing that, you know, very often producers will wait for buyers to call them, or if they're a little bit more proactive, what they're going to do is call three or four buyers around them, typically their sort of first go-to, indicate, you know, I have roughly this amount to sell, this is roughly the price I'm looking for, and this is roughly the period of the year that I'm looking for this grain to basically transfer title, and here's the quality I think I have. So we had to kind of take that process and convert it into, well, let's effectively create a listing of here's my grain for sale. And that kind of gave us sort of the backbone of the initial platform. Added to it is, well, when you're negotiating, what are the things you negotiate on? So I'd already mentioned, you know, price, quantity, freight terms, movement period, clarification on the quality. So structured all that information and basically mimicked or co-opt the traditional over-the-phone process. So that was sort of the initial design. And then really in terms of establishing first customers, we really first went after the people we knew. In farming circles, you have your core family, then you have your cousins or relatives that may also be farming, and then you have the neighbors that trust and know you. And so it's kind of very initial core group to kind of give that trial run. And what we found over time is, in order to get buyers interested in the platform, the buyers are very interested in seeing grain that's available. And so what we've seen is if we can generate supply or, you know, showcase supply in a market, it's then a lot easier to have a conversation with a buyer. And what we'll do is we'll say, well, if we're targeting to build a supply base, say, in Saskatchewan, we'll go talk to buyers. And typically we've seen sort of mid to smaller size buyers as our initial adopters because they just don't have the same amount of manpower or physical presence or brand equity, so to speak, in the farmer community in order to just be able to access grain in many different geographies or different parts of a province all at once. And so we would approach them and say, you know, we have grain listed available for sale. If you're interested, all you need to do is create an account and basically start negotiating with the farmer that is offering this grain for sale. And the good thing is you don't owe us anything until we actually deliver value, i.e. you've actually managed to secure a deal that you're interested in and that makes sense for you. And so, you know, one of the key principles on our site, whether it's for a producer or farmer or whether it's for a grain buyer, is it's entirely free to create an account, entirely free to list grain, entirely free to get into a negotiation process or an interaction with a potential buyer or seller. We only get paid if we actually help you secure a deal, i.e. we actually deliver value to you. And I think that that is something that resonates quite a bit in the agricultural community. There's a saying, or there's, I think, one of the statements I like to refer to is people in the farming world, and particularly farmers, can smell bullshit from a mile away. And I think, no pun intended, but it's a pun that makes a lot of sense in that context. But really what it is people like to see value. People like to test things. People like to kind of feel it's legit and real before they pay for something. Now, the other thing is obviously the agricultural community is a community that, you know, likes to have a good level of assurance before they try something new. You have to factor in that as a producer in particular, you're constantly managing risk. You have weather exposure risk, you have market exposure risk, and you have a variety of risks when you're growing a crop. And so you like to bet or take your time to ease your way into things that are brand new. you effectively, again, to not borrow an expression, but is very real in this context, you don't bet the farm. You don't bet your entire grain harvest on a brand new way of marketing. You might try a little bit left, right, and center, and then you try a little bit. If you like it, you try more, and you get confident over time as to what's the best use of an application like this for your case. Same thing with the buyers. You know, buyers operate in a very fast environment. Typically, when buyers are securing grain, they're also actually taking a position in financial markets because they're hedging their price exposure. They buy the grain at a certain price. They're going to try to resell it at a certain margin. But in the meantime, they don't really want to worry about, does the market go up or down? They're going to manage that price exposure by hedging in the futures market. You may or probably are familiar with the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn futures, soybean futures, that's what I'm referring to. An important thing and an important distinction is we focus on what's called the physical grain market, the market where I give you physical grain and you give me cash. It's different than the CBOT, Chicago Board of Trade financial market, but there's a clear link there, especially for the buyers, because they buy a position in the physical market and they immediately hedge it in the financial market. I'm saying this because also for the buyers, we had to confirm to them or show to them it's important that this agreement on the platform is binding on the seller, because the last thing a buyer wants to do is think they've bought grain and then basically go off into the financial market, take a position there that kind of balances out their physical position, only to find out, whoops, that grain's not actually sold to me. That's really problematic. And that's still something that we're constantly improving, but we also appreciated from the buyer point of view, this was very important for them to solve. So, you know, that's kind of been the approach that we take into and so sort of getting things up and running and getting into the market. And we're constantly learning. We've discovered originally that we went the very traditional approach in marketing and agriculture, which is you go to trade shows. But we've also over time discovered that, in particular, my business partner writes a fair amount of commentary on grain markets, which helps show that we know something about grain markets. And then through that build of confidence can show, oh, well, we actually know something about farming or grain marketing or grain markets. We also have a platform where you can actually enact our recommendations about how to buy or when to buy and sell. You could use the marketplace to sell grain. And I would say the last thing is, you know, there's this concept, Paul Graham, you know, do things that don't scale. When you're trying to change the way an industry approaches things, we certainly will help, especially first-time users on the platform. We'll guide them through their first deal. We'll kind of see if they have, let's say, a farmer post grain for sale, a buyer gives them, you know, an offer. We'll give them a call and walk them through how to interpret this offer on the platform, whether to accept it, whether to respond, how to respond, because we want to make sure that, especially for first-time users, there's a good piece of hand-holding. It's kind of like, well, we'll give you the two-wheel bike, but we'll keep the safety wheels for the first transaction so that you feel comfortable. And then after that, we'll take the safety wheels off and you'll be comfortable to go on your own. And so that's also been something that we really kind of insist on spending time with, sort of this customer support or customer success concept, make sure that both the farmers and the buyers that are giving the platform a try have success in that first attempt or those first couple attempts of transactions.
No, that's brilliant. I really loved your saying about hedging their bets. It's brilliant beyond belief because, you know, there is so much kind of going on. And actually kind of felt like you took me to a place in a movie where I was on the trader floor going and buy wheat, buy grain, buy soy, you know, sell. So, channeling my inner stock market wannabe personality.
There you go.
I love that.
Well, maybe you should join the grain trade.
I know nothing about it. I'll be selling and buying all the wrong stuff. So what else excites you most about this industry? Because honestly, I've been so overwhelmed by all the number of requests regarding the agricultural industry. It is like seriously booming and shaping and shifting.
Yeah. So in taking a bit sort of a higher level view, you know, we're focusing on one piece of the broader transformation, I think, that is going on in agriculture. But you know, we focus really on the commerce. We connect the buyers and the sellers, which, you know, from my point of view, everyone's been very focused on biotech and precision agriculture. which are super exciting pieces of technology that are coming into the industry. But let's not forget, at the end of the day, you got to sell the stuff, and it's a physical thing that, you know, is bulky and needs to move. But putting that aside, and, you know, everything that we're doing to kind of bring digital to the commerce side of agriculture, if I take a bit the higher view, I think there's a couple key things that are happening in ag that I find super exciting. You know, having grown up on a farm, I live by my parents' farm, I go back every chance I get. But, you know, there's kind of this marriage, so to speak, of this revolution in biotech. Everyone talks about GMOs, biotech and agriculture. That was the very early days. That was biotech technology 1.0. We're now getting to a point where we're able to edit the naturally existing DNA in a plant. You know, original GMOs were about importing some foreign DNA from a bacteria into a plant because that bacteria secreted a toxin or brought a resistance to a herbicide that we wanted to embed into the plant, or secrete a toxin that would kill, you know, a worm that would eat in the corn plant. But, you know, that was fairly crude. What we can do now is just take a corn plant and say, I want to boost genes that seem to embed tolerance on drought, or I want to take a soybean gene and tweak a bit the genes that indicate the oils content production such that it has an oil profile that makes it better instead of a trans fat. And the applications start demultiplying. You can even think, well, we've bred tomatoes to grow super fast and grow very and preserve themselves very well in a sort of a supply chain environment. You know, we may have lost some of the taste along the way. Actually, we could do both today. We could sort of create a good, high production, robust, transportable tomato where we also reactivate the genes around taste. And so this biotech is also very much enabled by data and technology, because we can analyze genomes, but we got to crunch all that information to kind of navigate our way through the DNA and the bio world. And so the marriage of those two are opening up a huge slew of possibilities that I find fascinating, you know, putting aside whether there's an appetite or not from the consumer point of view. But there are clear benefits, I think, of making plants that are of much better taste or better criteria, more effective in how they're produced and so forth. It's a question of appreciating what they can do and whether or not that makes sense from a consumer point of view. The other thing, though, that is super interesting is, you know, there's been this focus in agriculture very much on yield. It's all about the new hybrid, more fertilizer, or more efficient use so that we drive yield. But what we're discovering today is with a lot of this precision agriculture equipment, where we can detect in the field which parts produce more, which parts produce less, which point in the plant's growth stage based on models of how much sun, rain, when we seeded it, et cetera, should we actually put more fertilizer down? And the other thing we're realizing is it makes sense to put fertilizer a bit more intensely in one part of the field, but actually a lot less in another part of the field. This is what we call prescription maps in agriculture. It also makes sense to put more seeds per acre or per hectare in one part of the field and less in another, because we're finding out that one part of the field is actually able to support a lot more yield than another. And so putting all these things together, we're actually realizing that we can be a lot more environmentally effective and resource effective with fertilizer, with seed in agriculture, and produce the same yield, perhaps more yield. Or frankly, we're even realizing maybe there's parts of the field we should just take out of production because they're always going to be a low producing area. And maybe we convert that into a wetland or a carbon sink, whatever we want to do. So what's, I think, really changing in agriculture is we're no longer just thinking about tons for the sake of tons or bushels for the sake of bushels. We are actually thinking, what's the best ROI for all the resources that I'm putting in into my field, whether it's the amount of seeds, fertilizer, whether it's irrigation, whether it's which land am I using to produce? And so that's causing a big shift in the way farmers have to approach their business. It also means new skills. People have to kind of have that savviness of being a good farmer, I think, is going to evolve over time about not just having the best looking field or the best yield, but actually being able to determine that's actually the best yield for the amount of resources I put in. Or that is a smart investment in boosting a bit my yield because the market is indicating to me that based on the prices, it makes sense at this point to invest, I don't know, an extra $5 per acre of fertilizer because the boost in yield is going to yield an extra $50 in sales per acre of corn or soybean or whatever, and that's a 10-to-1 investment ratio. And I'm simplifying a little bit. It's never a 10-to-1, but you know, I have a 20% or 5% upside on that decision versus, maybe we're in a situation in the market where it doesn't make sense. I should just accept a lower yield because investing to get more yield is just not going to return the economic return. And so all this to say, digital, having these sensors, understanding sort of the broader economics of a field, factoring in everything you put into it, and also, you know, the impact on yield and how much more money do I make or less money do I make, plus what's the better use of resources, including land and the environmental components, is super exciting. And I think we're just seeing the tip of that. And I go this and tie this to a last piece, which is consumers at the other end are becoming a lot more interested in this. And so if there's a will to recognize producers that are going to do the effort to do this on sort of the more sustainable criteria, not just the ROI economic for the producer, that is already happening today. You use these tools to drive just the ROI, the pure economics. But if there's value or recognition around, oh, this is a unique variety, or this was produced in a certain way, and this is interesting and kind of create a bit this concept of this grain can actually a bit be differentiated in the market because digital allows more of that visibility all the way down the supply chain, there could be some really interesting new forms of thinking about what am I producing and can I almost brand or identify myself as a particular type of producer because there's a market need for that just as much as there's a market need for big volume, low cost corn, soybean to either feed cattle or produce biofuels or a plastic derivative, whatever it happens to be. But I think, you know, all these things are going to also end up drifting into, you know, I think different market segments that aren't as visible as they could be today. So that was a bit of a long piece, but it's to share a little bit, you know, why I'm more broadly excited about agriculture. This was where I spent a lot of time at my previous employer at McKinsey, and then kind of tying the farm world I grew up, the bigger trends I see in the world, and then obviously back into a startup that's very focused on one segment of agriculture, which is for us. If we can find a way to tie what these producers are producing and link them to the best buyer for whatever that be, whether it's sustainable, specialty grains, big volume corn, you name it, we're very excited about playing our part in that big overall trend.
No, it's amazing. It's really fascinating. Like, it seems to be like endless opportunities that have been enabled with all this data and technology. You know, maybe one day I'll finally have Brussels sprouts that taste like strawberries. It looks like the technology may be able to alter the DNA might be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and those are, again, like you might view that, whoops, that's crazy. We'd never want that. But then there's other things like, well, one of the things that's coming to market, but there's a bit of a TBD whether there'll be a full uptake, is the Arctic Fox apple, which is hitting consumer shelves in the U.S., I think, as we speak. It's an apple that doesn't brown. The application is, well, you peel these apples, you put them into plastic bags that are conditioned, say, typically with nitrogen or whatnot, and they don't turn brown. So you create a nice consumer packaged product that looks very appealing and maybe will drive more fruit consumption. You know, that's kind of the, I'm making the pitch for it, but it does have some genetic modifications that, okay, maybe people want it, don't want it, right? But there's many, many different permutations that we could see come down the road. It'll be a question of properly educating consumers. And then if consumers are like, yeah, I think that's actually a good trade-off, I'm interested in that, or actually I don't want it, forget it. Actually, maybe there's one other area where I think it's super interesting is we're seeing, you know, robotics come into the space, and we're seeing, and there's, you know, just to share a bit of tidbit, there's kind of a raging debate in sort of organic classification right now, which is a crop that is produced in a completely enclosed, controlled environment where, because it's enclosed, and the fascinating story behind this, this came from clean rooms in silicone fabs, where, you know, the environment is extremely clean. Well, if you produce plants in an extremely clean environment, you don't have the risk of weeds dropping seeds in there. You don't have insects, which could be pests, and you can only keep beneficial insects if you want. You know, fungi is always a little bit difficult. Spores are very small. But, you know, you get to the point where you have these production environments where we don't need herbicides, pesticides, or fungicides because the environment's so clean. And so you say, well, that's effectively an organic definition. You're not using any synthetic chemicals. We can, okay, synthetic fertilizer can be a different debate because that would typically not be organic. But then you have this notion, well, if it doesn't grow in soil in this enclosed environment, it's not organic. And so now you have this debate about, well, technology enables us to meet one goal of a very clean, chemical light or chemical free production, but it's in a bit of an artificial environment relative to where a plant usually grows. And then you have a debate. Well, what's true? What's natural? What's GMO? No, it must, non-GMO, it must grow in soil versus it doesn't. Or sorry, is it organic or not if it grows in soil or not? So this is sort of the world of robotics and closed environments that enable this. So anyway, I could go on and on, but there's other things we could talk about.
Yeah, no, I love the passion. You can feel it. You can feel it through the phone. This is amazing. So this journey must have had quite a few different curveballs that you've been thrown. You know, I would love to learn more about that. Like, what were some biggest aha moments or lessons that you've learned in this venture or another venture or something that you wish someone had told you?
Yeah, so I think, you know, kind of taking a step back, a couple of big lessons. So my first exposure to entrepreneurship was actually at a class at MIT called Energy Ventures. I'm also a big energy nut, and there's actually some interesting intersections between agriculture and energy, but we'll park that for today. But one of the key things that they instilled in that class was, don't just look at your belly button and think of a business concept and write a business plan. Talk to customers. And talking to customers really kind of helps you understand whether you're onto the right value proposition. Does your product make sense? How should you charge for it? What do they like, not like? And I think that as much as when you're starting, you have to keep doing that as you evolve your product. And I think one of the things or lessons that I think, you know, certainly in, you know, more recently FarmLead is we've assumed a bit for a while that, oh, we come from the farm, we know exactly what to do. But things are changing and we don't farm every day and we don't market grain every day. We have a good view on it, but the nitty gritty day to day of how it's being done is something that it's worth to talk to producers or buyers to really understand what they're doing and how you need to tweak your product. And so, you know, one of the things that we've forced ourselves is to reinstill a discipline of talking to customers about our product, about where we're going next, about what's working, not working, at least once a month. We have a customer advisory board. But now we're moving into more, let's talk to the customers or the potential customers that are kind of using our service, but not fully using it the way we'd like them to use it. And, you know, it's to quote Bill Gates here, it's from the customers who don't, I don't have the exact quote, but it's the notion the customers that don't like your product or that aren't happy are the ones that learn, that teach you the most about your product. And I think that that's something that we're now trying to really force ourselves into the discipline of doing that more and more. And another thing we were literally doing today is we call it internally eat your own dog food, which is we stop the entire company for a full hour for once a month, and everyone gets on our mobile apps, our web version of our application, and tries to buy and sell grain. It gets a little funny because people get, you know, very original in how they describe their grain and whatnot. So coming out of it, we end up with two things. We end up with a lot of aha moments on new bugs, improvements to the features, things that we just hadn't paid attention to. And then we end up with also sort of the best five funniest sort of negotiations that took place during that, which is more just the fun side of it. But really what it does is it literally forces us to eat our own dog food and kind of realize we think this is what customers are experiencing, but wow, this kind of really sucks. We have to fix this. Or wow, this is confusing. Like, I'm confused and I'm the one who built this. How the heck is a customer going to understand how to get through this? So I would say kind of this whole theme of making sure you stay close to your customers is very important. Another area where we've learned or run into issues is, you know, there's this concepts of hire slow, fire fast. I kind of blended into don't tolerate jerks. It's a Netflix CEO who says that, and there's no room for brilliant jerks. I think that's an era where, you know, in your early days, you really are desperate for the key people that you need, and you kind of do that. But after a while, you realize, you know, maybe I shouldn't be hiring so fast until I'm really sure I've got the right person. Because in hindsight, you realize hiring a person isn't either suited based on a skill set or just not in a position to adapt or frankly, just not pleasant to work with can really damage your productivity and or sour the well, particularly if they're not, they're sort of the brilliant jerk category. And so, you know, learning to really have the discipline or be able to realize faster that you're in one of those situations and pull yourself back when you're tempted to either hire someone that isn't exactly right or to make excuses for someone that just isn't fitting for whatever reason is, I think, a key lesson or something to remember at all times. You know, I talked more sort of on the business side, the notion of it was clear that putting grain up in front of producers made a lot of sense. That was an important, like, get that supply side of the marketplace up and running. So really tailoring all our onboarding to really focus on the producers or the sellers and get them to post grain as a go-to-market strategy, I think makes a ton of sense. Yeah, those are kind of, say, key areas. I would say the other one sort of general thing that I like to really do is be transparent in the company. And really, I'm a big sort of Jack Welch or sort of, you know, the notion that you can't manage what you don't measure. And so I think one of the things that I've learned over time is you actually have a lot of information. You either get obsessed about, oh, we'll do that later, or build, you know, a really sophisticated way of measuring and compiling with all these beautiful charts and automated and whatnot, but really just dump the data into Excel, get a bunch of pivots going in Excel, and just see what you're learning through that information. And that, I think, is something that, you know, looking back, really forcing yourself to do that earlier, to understand what's going on with your product, to understand what people are doing in your application, but also to showcase your overall performance. How many users that show up are actually posting, are actually doing a deal? How often are they doing a deal? How often are they in the application? What are they doing in the application? And then tying that back to how much is it costing me to acquire that user? How many of those users that I'm acquiring as leads or that just are registered users are becoming true customers that are generating revenue for me? And sort of what's the link between the two and the ratio to kind of bring to light, is my business working? And if it's not working, where is it not working? You know, take the time to really do that. But also, don't be ashamed to show it across the company so that everyone understands, ah, this is how we're doing and this is where we need to go. Align on that goal. What is that goal? You know, is the goal, you know, drive more conversion or reduce the cost of bringing new users, or those don't matter right now. It's about acquiring more users. But get that goal clear by understanding the state of your business and then show it to everyone, I think, is extremely helpful. So that was, I think, another area where we were a little bit too much relying on your gut, which you do have to do sometimes, but you have more information than you think, and take the time to look at it. And once you look at it, share it with everyone.
Oh, I love that. That's really inspirational. And I love that don't eat your dog food. And that even talks about that in terms of also even metrics and measurement as well. That's a brilliant advice. So was there, in this journey, was there any tools or resources you were able to leverage from either the government or other types of groups?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, in our context, we were successful with some of the NRC or IRAP type grants to kind of put the initial versions of our platform together. We had some support from the Ontario Centers of Excellence as young entrepreneurs trying to grow our business in particular Ontario. We've had some support in kind from Saskatchewan to help us do some market analysis. So those are sort of the classic ways to fund your business without giving away a ton of equity or taking on a ton of debt. So those are certainly areas where we've benefited tremendously. The other area where I think we've had a lot of help, especially in sort of when we were a 4 or 5 person team, kind of getting organized, we kind of agreed, okay, you know, we need a bit of a real center, and we kind of split ourselves between our original base in Saskatchewan, where we still have a small physical presence, but then we also set up an actual kind of core presence that we've now built into our headquarters in Ottawa. But we landed at the Invest Ottawa incubator, and there, you know, we leveraged every entrepreneur in residence we could get. It was basically drink from the fire hose or digital marketing 101, how to negotiate your fundraising 101, how to think about product and UX 101. It was just gobbled everything we could, and we got tremendous value out of that because we kind of learned all the skills that you need to have, the multiple hats that you need to wear, especially when you're in the early days as, you know, early startup founders or first employees. I need to get up to speed on XYZ, you know, digital marketing. And because really what it helped us very concretely is run a couple of experiments in digital marketing so that we could show, actually, you know, if we're going out to raise, dear investor, digital could actually be a channel. Now, we haven't done, you know, 2 years of experiment and experience in this, but we've seen that over 3-4 months of running a couple trials, things work, right? That we wouldn't have got without that. Well, here's your digital marketing 101. Now, you also quickly realize, okay, there's a lot more to this. I think I now need to hire someone because I can't keep up with it, or kind of go to level 2 or level 3 or level 4 of what I can do with this. But there's been a lot of sort of mentorship that we've gotten from the entrepreneurs and residents. And I think the other last thing is you get a lot of peers from it. You see other startups who've just been through what you've been through or about to go through it. Or sometimes, frankly, you identify a startup that maybe be struggling a little bit and you see, okay, there's one or two people there that really have the skill set that I may be looking for. Got to make sure I'm going to stay in touch with them because when I'm ready to hire, you know, maybe they'll be available. And we've had one or two or three employees that have joined us just like that. So, you know, it's kind of this band of things that we've been able to leverage over time that has really helped us.
No, that's brilliant. Mentorship and learning from others and talking to others that are outside your space is a common theme that I see in all the different podcasts we've launched. And I really, because you can't be successful on your own, so you really do need to leverage all the different tools around you. And there's tons of entrepreneurs that I see that still, they don't want to share anything and they want to keep that veil very closely to them. So this is brilliant. Really brilliant insights. Is there any other advice you might want to provide to any of the aspiring or budding other Canadian innovators out there?
Yeah, actually, I think there's a lot of, it's changed a lot. Like, I think over the last 5, maybe 10 years, entrepreneurship has been demystified a lot. But the thing that I always like to think about is really all you have to lose is your pride, right? And if you can accept that it's tough, it's a challenge, and you know, worst case, okay, you've tried, you gave it a really good run, you learned a ton, you can say, I gave this a run, what do you have to lose? Okay, you lost maybe 2 years or 3 years of a career opportunity. You say, well, I'm an entrepreneur, you know, went through a lot of stress, a lot of nights, worked hard, but I learned a ton, had fun. But very often people on the outside who don't understand it or are on sort of a very strong career track or very successful in other ways or just are like, wow, I could never do that. They think, oh, this is crazy. I wouldn't do this. How can you do this? How do you sleep at night? And my answer to that is you actually build a bit of a shell to it. You just get used to it. You accept what you're going into, that risk is part of the equation. Challenge is part of the equation. Discovery is part of the equation. Not always knowing what lies ahead or what to do is part of the equation. But once you kind of get over those first 3-4 months of, oh, no, 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 you realize this is just a giant roller coaster. Right now I'm having a giant week where I'm on a huge high. Now I'm in a terrible week and it's the doldrums. But actually, if I look back 3 months ago, it was kind of the same thing. I had a high. Now I have a bit of a rougher week. Now I have a better week. And sometimes it's, I have 3 amazing weeks, then 2 bad weeks. And so that's a bit the shell of the comfort you grow with. And so once you get used to that and you get used to, if I look back, will I regret not have taken this leap? If the answer is yes, do it. Because worst case, the experience and what you've learned will be invaluable and you're going to find a job. You will be back okay again. And so I think those are kind of the two kind of core threads of it's not, it shouldn't be as mystical as it often is made. It is hard, but you get used to it. And frankly, there's a lot of upside and a lot of fun to it and a lot of learning that makes the tougher moments practically insignificant in the grander scheme of things.
I love that. Those are such wise, wise words. So since you've got so many different hats that you're juggling, is there a popular productivity tool that you use to stay on top of it all?
Yeah, so there's, or sort of tools that I avoid, maybe would be the other way to look at it. So there's a couple things. One is you know, Slack, instant messaging. Many people have seen it. I actually don't hesitate to mute or to not look at it because it can be a real distraction to constantly be on the go, go, go operationally. And so sometimes you need to pull yourself out of the day-to-day. And my role, I run the day-to-day operations. My title says COO. It's effectively what I do. But I view a lot of my role as debottlenecking or helping other people go faster by jumping in and out where I can. But sometimes I have to take my own time to either think about a business development opportunity or, you know, the bigger picture of where the product is going, or we got to fix a process here, but I need to take half a day to really think this process through. I could have more discipline around that, but it means try not to look at email constantly. Maybe look at it 2-3 times a day if you can. Shut the Slack channels that aren't important. The other thing is remove yourself from things that you've pushed yourself to delegate to others. And so as my role has evolved, I used to handle a lot of bugs. As sort of, I play the product interim manager, product manager. We had a product manager. As he was onboarding, I was still very close to the bugs because he didn't know the system inside out, what was causing underlying bugs. And that channel was literally called Bugs for Alarm on Slack. And so one day we said, okay, I'm going to pull out of it and we're going to change the name. And that's effectively what we did. And then there was the same. I used to be very close to the development team and there was the dev channel. And I had to like just say, today is the day I'm out. And I heard after this, oh yeah, when you left that channel, there was just a celebration and a party. And I was like, that's fine. I don't even need to know what you guys said. Point being that at some point you have to get out of the way. You have to let other people own it. You have to let other people fail or succeed. And what you basically move from is instead of, uh-oh, I need to support you, roll up my sleeves, help you, you need to make sure that a lot of these tools that allow you to get into many things, you move away from them so that you really let people kind of drive and own it. And it's a bit of a short-term pain, but it's long-term gain because then your company grows, people feel ownership, they feel proud, they want to drive it, but then you just say, well, what are the expectations? What are you responsible for? Go. So sorry, this drifted from tools into sort of also a kind of way of sort of approaching or being productive. But being productive also means if you give someone the keys, let them drive, really. That's that. And but be disciplined about letting them drive, right? The other thing that I try to do is I'm a big user of Notes. Believe it or not, I'm an old school PC guy because I love Excel and pivots, but that's a different story. But but I use Notes and I really just have a giant set of notes and I try to really order it and kind of revisit it every couple of days. Top is top priority. The other stuff is things to keep in mind, but I'm not going to rush into it. And really this kind of came from this notion of there's a famous book called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And one of the key things there is kind of really define what's top priority and focus on that because don't let yourself be distracted by day-to-day operations. You can make yourself feel busy very quickly, but then you don't work on the important stuff. That's a key thing that I also try to do.
No, that's brilliant. I mean, honestly, there's so much value bombs here. This is amazing stuff. So you mentioned the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Is that a book that you recommend to others, or is there another book that you're currently reading or you would recommend to others?
So I think Seven Habits of Highly Effective People is kind of just read it at some point in your life. Like I read it, I was 20 or something. But it's just like, oh, go back to core principles now and then. It's a classic. I think it's been around for 50 years. But there's a couple good things in there. I think there's another key one around that, which is try not to talk badly about other people when they're not around, because I think it just helps establish sort of your reputation of someone that, you know, has something good to say about someone. But it doesn't mean you can't be candid. It's just when you're with that person, it doesn't establish you as someone who's kind of, it's good for your broader reputation. Let's put it that way. So there's a couple of nice principles in there know what your values are and try to focus. And, you know, it's kind of basic at points, but it's a good view. One book that I read recently that I was like a massive epiphany or very helpful, and I think plenty of companies are going to face this type of situation and plenty of teams, is The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And this is not to say, okay, Farmly's a highly dysfunctional place and we have huge problems. It's like any company we grow, our team changes from two co-founders to two co-founders and maybe a tech lead to, okay, we kind of now have 5, 6, 7 people kind of running things. And that's a team. And that team needs to work like just an amazing team, but you need to have certain things in place in a team, and you need to have things like people need to be very comfortable being vulnerable. People need to be very comfortable being able to say what they think. People need to be able to talk about ideology in a way that they don't feel is personal, because it's through that process that the real important things that you need to talk about as your business come out. People through that can align on a goal, because if a team knows exactly what the goal is, then they can decide, well, everything we need to do and be accountable to the team needs to align with that goal. And I'm literally giving you sort of the stack of, I really like these principles in this book. It's the last thing is egos out the door. If you are celebrating something because you're amazing and all you talk about is, well, we're succeeding because of me, you don't get it. No, it's the team that needs to succeed against the goal, and you contribute against that goal, and it's all about the team. And if a teammate is struggling, they're comfortable saying it because they're vulnerable and they need help, and they feel they're not going to be, you know, suffer because of speaking, I'm struggling, or I need help, or this is going great, or I don't think this works. And then you kind of, the team can work towards solving. And this is really the leadership team. It's not, the leaders aren't accountable to their individual sub teams. They're accountable to the broader leadership team. So read this book. If you're kind of like, how do I make my team perform in an amazing way? And I read it and I was like, okay, this was not mandatory. It was highly suggested reading for the Christmas holidays this year. And I kind of gave a copy to everyone and was like, read it. I think it's going to help us gel and really function as a team. And kind of, I think it's, you know, 3-4 weeks in, starting to kind of apply some of the things in there have been extremely helpful.
No, that's great. I'm going to make sure I put it in the show notes for everyone so they'll be able to easily click on it and get access to it. And we also have a lot of international listeners out there. So do you have a favorite Canadian city, town, restaurant, hideaway, or food?
I'll answer that a little bit differently. I'm a farmer. I'm a nature guy. I love to garden, but grow vegetables, not as much the flower side of it. And I grew up as a kid, I used to drive my mother nuts boiling maple sap on the family oven. I think I probably just drove her electricity bill up, and, you know, given electricity prices in Ontario today, I don't think she'd let me do that anymore. But I love making or playing around with maples and making maple syrup, which is sort of a classic, iconic Canadian product. You know, it's very good on pancakes and whatnot. But if you ever have a chance and you're visiting Canada in kind of the February, March period, go to a sugar shack. We literally call it a sugar shack for the non-Canadian listeners out there. And it's kind of a moment in the end of the Canadian winter. The sun is out. It's 5-6 degrees daytime. It's still -4, -5 at night. And we're boiling these giant amounts of sap. We poke little holes in trees and it drips away. And we collect 40 liters of this, a liter or two. No, it's probably 4 or 5 liters of tree, or a tap, as we call it, the hole we put in the tree. And we need 40 liters of that stuff. And we boil it up and we turn it into a liter of maple syrup. Or if we boil it a little bit more, it becomes a caramel that freezes instantly on snow. It's called maple taffy, and you just eat it and you sugar yourself out. If you have concerns around sugar or diabetes, don't go nuts. Be careful. It's very sweet. But that's the combination of the end of the winter, the whole phenomenon of sap and boiling in this big room for the boiling water, and out of it comes this sweet, syrupy, taffy thing that you roll on snow because it's beautiful sunshine. That's something I like.
I love it. Now I've got a good sugar craving going on because February is around the corner. So finally, how can our listeners connect with you?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm a little bit of an older person, so I'm not the biggest of Twitter users. But if you ping me, I'm at the Goobs, T-H-E-K, capital G or G-O-U-B-S. You can always check out FarmLead, what we're doing. We're at FarmLead, L-E-A-D, and ping me on LinkedIn. Just ping me and say, hey, rather the podcast so that I know that's how you found me, and then send me an invite with that comment, and we'll figure out a way to connect.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time, Alain. You are brilliant beyond belief. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to share war stories, lessons learned, and the exciting world of entrepreneurship and agriculture. So thank you very much for having me.
Cheers. Excellent. Thank you, innovators, for joining us this week. Our Facebook page is moving and growing each week, so please join us. I post a lot of interesting articles about Canadian innovation trends, the movers, the shakers, plus things that I think are just funny. And if you know any Canadian innovators that should be featured, drop us a line. I love getting feedback and hearing from everyone. You can contact me on email, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and of course, hint, hint, even in the review. I'm still channeling Theory B, that ratings and reviews are my oxygen. And remember, this is our podcast. I look forward to hearing and chatting with you next week.